quiz teams.
We need to bring that back, actually. I need to talk to my paper about bringing that back.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Todd Alba Show.
Trumpster asked the judge and said, hey, can I not come to court because I want to go to my son's graduation? So here now, from the raw story, Trump plans Minnesota fundraiser on the day of Barron's graduation. When I graduated, you have a get-together with family and friends. It's kind of a day. A parent shouldn't just be ducking in and out.
You have to be a parent for that. And he is a parent in name only. A pino.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Hear that? That's the sound of your life. Perfectly imperfect. Beating in rhythm to the world you've created. But every time you drive after drinking, the music gets drowned out. Your life sounds pretty great. Don't let a buzz ruin it. Buzz driving is drunk driving. Don't drive buzzed. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts. You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us. The road construction season is underway, and you've probably noticed orange cones and barrels are back too. The world's leading manufacturer of these safety products is Lakeside Plastics. The family-owned business is based in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Do you know why the cones were originally created more than 75 years ago? As a safety marker to keep drivers away from newly painted lines on the road, as an object for drivers to weave around to mark the tops of houses for small airplane pilots. The answer's coming up.
Message that we can get out. We need to have a safe work zone.
Safety is number one for Eric Witt. He's the I-41 project supervisor for the work between Deep Here and Appleton, where you'll be seeing a lot of those orange cones. Did you guess why the cones were originally created? To keep drivers away from wet paint lines on the road. Now, cones like those made at Lakeside Plastics in Oshkosh warn about any kinds of hazards ahead. That is one safe slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Guaranteed income programs give no strings attached cash payments to low-income households. They can be controversial, but research shows they work. Mike Mohn has more.
The city of Madison gained attention for a program that ran from 2022 to 2023, where eligible households received $500 in monthly payments. Elsewhere in the U.S., the nonprofit Up Together has helped cities facilitate payments that come with no strings attached. The group's Rachel Barnhart says last year they helped 26,000 families access $18 million in unrestricted cash. Based on their outreach, all of it was spent on basic necessities.
Like housing, food, utilities, transportation, child care.
She says respondents note the assistance has improved their mental well-being while allowing some to enroll their kids in after-school activities. There has been pushback, with skeptics arguing these programs discourage people from working. Even though Madison's effort was privately funded, Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin sought to prohibit taxpayer funding of these initiatives. The bill was vetoed. Barnhart says a key example from Texas shows how important the payments are during an escalating housing crisis.
What the Urban Institute found in Austin was a majority of the cash payments was spent on housing. And we saw an increase in housing stability.
She suggests a growing patchwork of these payments would serve as a shield against evictions as tenants struggle with skyrocketing rents. There are long-standing forms of cash assistance, but those come with more requirements, and Barnhart argues there's an uneven approach among states to distribute the aid to recipients. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm Corey Hartman with your forecast. For today, sunshine and highs in the mid-80s. For tonight, partly cloudy, chance of a shower or thunderstorm, a low around 55. On Sunday, mostly sunny, a high of 82. Showers and storms Sunday night, a low around 61. Showers and storms for Monday with a high near 81.
Currently, 66 degrees.
Crude and Dom.
Tune in Monday to the greatest radio show ever. Dom and Crude, we're doing it live. Your calls, your text. Join us, Devil's Advocates.
The Devil's Advocates. Weekdays 4 till 6. News from the Center, WRCE.
I gave a letter to the postman. He put it in his sack.
Welcome to this, our weekly weekend-venued broadcast here on the stations of Civic Media and throughout the state of Wisconsin. Yes, that's right. This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host, your on-air host here on the stations of Civic Media for the next 2 hours, both on this hour and next hour as well. Our broadcast, Amicus, a Law Review, takes its name from our adopted and our embraced commission, and that is to conduct review and examination and analysis, a deliberation of the recent news of our times in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America and beyond. As we have said in these several weeks since reconstituting and redesigning our weekend program, Amicus. Amicus is a law term. It's a legal term. It's derived from the Latin, as many, if not all of you know, to describe a friend, ami. Ami, that portion of amicus, means friend. It's an individual or maybe an organization that assists and promotes some understanding, some appreciation of the relevant issues of attention or resolution by a body, a court, some sort of entity in government that needs assistance, needs information, needs background, needs some guidance that can be specially provided by that ami, that amicus. That's where we get our name from. That's the legal term, and that's the derivation of it. And so, true to that commission, offering information, insight, perspective, or expertise, that is the purpose of our weekend broadcast, Amicus, a Law Review. And that is what we are going to be pursuing this weekend as well, as we do every weekend here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. That necessarily also involves you as friends of this broadcast and of Civic Media. You, our listeners, here on our broadcast stations in Wisconsin and beyond. And as always, we encourage you to be part of our discussion, specifically encouraging your questions and your inquiries about the subject matter of our topics, the things we're going to be talking about this weekend. Call in at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789, or text us also. Drop a note into our feed on the Civic Media app and be in touch with Max, who is my wonderful producer here in the studio of Civic Media in downtown Waukesha. I'm joined here by Max throughout this hour and next hour. We will be taking your inquiries, your questions about those rule of law related topics of our day right here on Amicus, a Law Review. Thank you so much for joining me this weekend for our discussion, our presentation, our review, our analysis of those major events in the areas of law and government that animate our lives and our livelihoods. Now, what is our syllabus, our agenda for this hour and also the next hour here on Amicus, a law review. Many, many things. Many, many things, as always, happening during the previous weeks, the previous days, that direct and animate our agenda. That includes, of course, the United States Supreme Court. Lots of activity this past week. Lots of activity coming out of the Supreme Court, and indeed announcing here on our weekend broadcast that we have now begun that period in the term of the United States Supreme Court when we will begin to receive over the period of the next 6 weeks. It began just this past week. The first cases, and now in the coming weeks, the remaining cases on the docket of the United States Supreme Court, major big ticket items to be resolved by the Supreme Court between now and the 4th of July, about 6 weeks from now. Supreme Court going to be issuing somewhere around 40, count them, 40 decisions in cases pending before it in this 2023-2024 term. Lots and lots of decisions, many of them hugely, hugely important. We are now in that period where on this broadcast and other broadcasts of civic media, we're going to be talking about what the Supreme Court is deciding. Plainly do not have the time, the bandwidth to talk about every single case, but there will be about 40 cases decided, and many of those, as we have discussed on this broadcast, critically important to understanding the world in which we live. We know, as we have discussed before, that one of the major topics before the Supreme Court in this term is guns. And we're going to chat again a little bit about what's coming up there. But more importantly, in our syllabus this weekend, we're going to talk about two major things that the United States Supreme Court did just this past week. One of them, a major voting rights case coming out of the state of Louisiana, affirming, as it has last term, in a case coming out of Alabama, now in Louisiana, affirming still in 2024 the continuing vitality of the Voting Rights Act, the options for ensuring that people are not disenfranchised when it comes to their voting capacities in the states of our great nation. A decision coming out of Louisiana, interestingly, not on the docket of those 62 cases, but a matter that has been the subject of resolution, affirming a lower court decision to ensure that the franchise, at least for now, remains viable and accessible for members of the population in Louisiana, specifically creating a second, principally majority all-black opportunity district in that state. We'll talk about what that case means. A second case that is on the docket, was on the docket, still remains on the docket of the Supreme Court. And this, a major case, we anticipated this happening. Still, it is good to see it when it happens, that a majority of the Supreme Court, not a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court, a 7-2 decision affirming the constitutionality of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, this major institution created by the Congress to ensure that rules and regulations that the interests of consumers and of people engaged in finances, as we all are, that they're protected by this federal agency. CFPB upheld by the Supreme Court just this past week. We will talk about the decision issued by the Supreme Court, authored perhaps surprisingly by a member of a Supreme Court from whom we would not expect it otherwise, but affirming absolutely, unequivocally, that the CFPB was constitutionally put together legislatively by the Congress. Nothing about that runs afoul of the basic tenets of the Supreme Court, including a thing called the Appropriations Clause of the Constitution. We'll talk about those two major cases, Louisiana and the CFPB. Necessarily at or near the end of our second hour here on Amicus Law Review, we are going to revisit some attention paid appropriately, stunningly, to Associate Justice Sam Alito, back in the news again, based upon the display of an American flag. That's right, you know this story. An American flag upside down on the flagpole at his home in Alexandria, Virginia. We'll talk about how that came to be. We'll talk about why that is important, not just in connection with that flag, the things that the Associate Justice said in connection with that, but we're going to go back and we're going to do some analysis of the cynicism, the contempt,
that the Associate Justice Sam Alito has had, not just including this flag matter, although that is an illustration of it. We're going to go back and talk about some of the things that he has written and most recently said from the bench of the Supreme Court that show contempt that he has for the basic structures and operations of our government, including the capacity of grand juries to act, of trial juries to act, of prosecutors, investigators, a contempt that he has had for the voting systems in our country generally. We're going to talk about a couple of those decisions that he has issued in connection with voting rights, in connection, yes, indeed, with the right that I maintain, most Americans still maintain, and here is in the Constitution, a privacy right to abortion that he found 2 years ago in this case called Dobbs, no longer in here, is no longer vested in the Constitution. We'll talk about Sam Alito at or near the end of our second hour, prompted by this flag matter, but going back and addressing in a larger way many of the ways that Sam Alito sends to us the message that he has contempt for the very government which he is a part of, contempt and cynicism for the oath of office that he has taken to support and defend the Constitution. Tough words, I know, but we're going to chat about that and, again, as always, invite your questions and even your comments about that as well. All of that wrapped up inside the United States Supreme Court attention, which begins again today and will continue certainly over the period of the next 6 weeks or so. All of that coming up here on our Saturday morning broadcast, in addition to our Sunday display of our program as well. Beyond that, we're going to talk about two other cases also pending in the courts of America, one in a federal court in New York, and that is a case against Senator Bob Menendez taking place quite literally almost across the street from the prosecution right now underway against Donald Trump. The case involving Bob Menendez, allegations by a federal grand jury that Bob Menendez and his wife and others have engaged in fraud and in corruption and in other ways undermining their oath of office. Bob Menendez on trial there in New York. We're also going to talk about Hunter Biden, who is going to be in trial, subject to prosecution in two federal courts on both ends of our nation, on the East Coast, the West Coast. We'll talk about that. And yes, indeed, we necessarily will talk this weekend on Amicus Law Review about what's going on in that Trump trial in Manhattan, continuing in the coming week, the possibility that the jury in that particular case, Donald Trump facing 34 different counts of violations of state law involving invoices and checks and registry items, allegations that are pending against him, the subject of several weeks of trial now likely concluding this coming week, certainly concluding with the prosecution case. We'll talk about the prospects of whether or not the defense will put on a case, and if so, what that may look like. If not, what the jury may have before it as soon as this coming week, facing the possibility that sometime in the next week to 10 days, the jury could be deliberating on this case that is making history in the annals of our nation, the first time in our nation's history that any former president has been prosecuted, brought into court for alleged crimes, state crimes, but crimes against the people of the state of New York in violation of those laws. We're going to talk about all of that, the Trump trial, the Biden trial, the Menendez trial, all of those things as we address here on our weekend broadcast, all of those issues about the rule of law in the United States of America.
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
The road construction season is underway, and you've probably noticed orange cones and barrels are back too. The world's leading manufacturer of these safety products is Lakeside Plastics. The family-owned business is based in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Do you know why the cones were originally created more than 75 years ago? As a safety marker to keep drivers away from newly painted lines on the road, as an object for drivers to weave around to mark the tops of houses for small airplane pilots.
The answer's coming up.
Message that we can get out. We need to have a safe work zone.
Safety is number one for Eric Witt. He's the I-41 project supervisor for the work between Deep Here and Appleton, where you'll be seeing a lot of those orange cones. Did you guess why the cones were originally created? To keep drivers away from wet paint lines on the road. Now, cones like those made at Lakeside Plastics in Oshkosh warn about any kinds of hazards ahead. That is one safe slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this hour of our weekend broadcast, and also the next hour, an awful lot on our docket this weekend to talk about in the areas of law and government and the aspiration of justice, and focusing with special attention on the United States Supreme Court. Yes, we are now in that six-week period near the end of its active portion of the term, in which it is going to be issuing cases among the 62 that is taken under its wing, taken under advisement in the wake of many oral arguments of the past term. We know that the Supreme Court has already issued 21 opinions in its docket up to this point. And included in that is a major decision of just this past week involving the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Another matter, not on that 62-numbered docket, but also involving the Voting Rights Act. We'll talk about those two cases as we think and look forward to the coming cases also to be decided in the days and weeks ahead. We have talked about some of the guns cases that the Supreme Court has in front of us. We are mindful as we gather together this weekend on Amicus, a law review, that we are coming just in the wake of the two-year anniversary of the horrific shooting in Buffalo, New York. The white supremacist who perpetrated that horrific shooting drove about 200 miles to target, yes, that's right, a predominantly black neighborhood in Buffalo, New York, went into a grocery store with an assault weapon, and yes, killed 10 black people, injured 3 others while they were shopping for groceries. The state has prosecuted that defendant and imposed upon him multiple life imprisonment terms. The federal government is also prosecuting. And yes, as you may recall, as we reported on this broadcast, the attorney general, in a rare move, has authorized prosecutors to seek the death penalty, to seek the federal death penalty in that prosecution, which is still going ahead in a federal court. We are mindful of Buffalo as we gather together on this broadcast this weekend, May 14th of 2022, that horrific event in the lives not only of those taken and injured, all the people in Buffalo, but all of us in the United States of America. 646 mass shootings in 2022, 656 in 2023, and only 5 months into 2024, we already have 157 of those mass shootings in America. And so in the midst of that, the Supreme Court addressing guns cases, we do not have decisions in these cases yet, but they will be coming in the next several weeks. Could be next week, could be 5 or 6 weeks from now. We don't know exactly what the timing of them is going to be, but we know at least about what those cases are about. One of them is Cargill. Garland versus Cargill is argued way back in February. A ban on bump stocks was implemented during the Trump administration at the center of this very important dispute pending before the Supreme Court. A Texas man forced to surrender his devices to comply the restriction on bump stocks. The case does involve the Second Amendment, but only collaterally, because the real attack is on whether or not the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms can properly outlaw bump stocks. Bump stocks are attachments, of course, to semi-automatic rifles that speed up their rate of fire. You all recall well that following the 2017 mass shooting at that music festival in Las Vegas, the shooter using semi-automatic weapons outfitted with bump stocks. Maybe the first time that many of us have heard about this thing. ATF, in the wake of that, the horrific violence on that day,
issued a ruling finding that a rifle equipped with a device qualifies as a machine gun under federal law. Machine guns are prohibited, and machine guns have been banned since 1986 under federal law. The justices heard argument in this case on February and grappling whether, once again, whether the ATF has the legal authority to impose that kind of rule to prohibit the use of bump stocks in the wake not only of the violence in Texas, but the violence, regrettably, throughout our nation. That's one of the gun cases pending in front of the Supreme Court. We know as well that the Supreme Court is also addressing at least one other case, similarly addressing the role of guns in America. This case involving an individual in Texas against whom there is a domestic violence restraining order. The federal law, once again, prohibiting anyone who is subject to a domestic restraining order from possessing, using in any way, possessing a weapon. And Mr. Rahimi, R-A-H-I-M-A, his name is the one that gives the name of the case, United States versus Rahimi, a very violent person by any measure, the subject of much of the oral argument way back in November of this past year, including a notorious exchange between the Chief Justice and counsel for Mr. Rahimi, in which the Chief Justice basically admonished the counsel for suggesting that his client is not violent. Very little doubt that Mr. Rahimi is a violent person. The question there is whether or not the Second Amendment as interpreted by the Supreme Court recently in this case called Bruin, that contemplates that before you can impose restrictions on the use, the sale, the manufacture, the transfer of weapons, you have to look back in history to figure out whether there's some antecedent, some predicate for imposing that restriction. Does Bruin prohibit the federal government from going ahead and prosecuting somebody like Mr. Rahimi, having a domestic violence restraining order against them, violating federal law by possessing then a weapon? And it appears from the oral argument back in February that they're inclined to leave in place that law that strips alleged domestic abusers of their firearms, including people like Mr. Rahimi. Several suggested that those deemed dangerous to society could in fact be disarmed, consistent with the Second Amendment, consistent with Bruin and other cases decided by the Supreme Court in history. Those two cases, among others, still on the docket of the Supreme Court, waiting decision in the coming weeks. Just do one or two more of those. A case called Moore versus United States, argued way back in December. The case involves a challenge to a fairly obscure provision of the sweeping tax reform package. Remember this one signed into law by Donald Trump in 2017? The mandatory repatriation tax is a one-time tax. It targeted U.S. taxpayers who hold shares of certain foreign corporations and requires them to pay a levy on their proportionate share of the company's earnings. That's what the attack is all about in this case called Moore. The tax was projected to generate roughly $340 billion in revenue over 10 years. A couple from Washington State challenging that tax as impermissible under the 16th Amendment. Supreme Court likely to leave that particular provision in place based upon the argument way back in December. Moore versus United States, a provision of Donald Trump's tax reform package, also a part of the cases before the Supreme Court coming up. Another case involving City of Grants Pass versus Johnson, argued in April, questioning whether the constitutionality of anti-camping laws, those argued back in April, determining the status of homeless people in our nation's dispute is the most significant involving homeless people to come before the Supreme Court in decades. The outcome could impact how cities and states respond to high rates of homelessness as encampments pop up on public property. All of those cases and more, 40 or so to be decided, guns cases, tax cases, case involving homelessness, all of that coming up before the Supreme Court in the weeks ahead. When we come back, we're going to talk more about decisions of the Supreme Court just this past week.
News from the Center, WRCE.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Student protester plans to occupy campus buildings go awry. At UPenn in Philadelphia last night, ABC's Brianna Smith at the scene.
And this all started when protesters said they began occupying Fisher Bennett Hall. Officers swarmed the campus to take the pro-Palestinian protesters into custody.
At the U of Chicago, protesters got into the politics building and confronted former Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp in her office.
Basically saying I needed to leave. I'm like, well, no, I don't.
And she didn't. Israeli military says it's recovered the bodies of three hostages kidnapped last October 7th. In Tel Aviv, ABC's Marcus Moore.
Israeli Defense Forces saying all three were killed by Hamas while they were trying to run from a music festival that Hamas gunmen raided in southern Israel, and their bodies were taken back to Gaza.
Utility crews working to fix about 500,000 power outages after Thursday's violent storms in Houston. This is ABC News.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Josh Hader gets the save. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers losing game one of their series in Houston. The crew had the lead but let it slip away in the fifth. Freddie Peralta giving up a three-run home run. Top of the ninth, Josh Hader in the game. Retiring his old team, the Brewers 1-2-3 as the Astros won 5-4 at Minute Maid Park. That's Hader's sixth save of the season. He now has recorded a save against all 30 major league teams. Sam Frelick went 1-3. Despite the loss, Frelick says the Brewers clubhouse is getting along fine right now.
Love everybody in this clubhouse. I think we all mesh really well together. Pitchers, position players, everybody, staff. So, yeah, when you get rolling like that and a game and in a week and stuff like that, it is contagious. Everyone feels good going into the next day, so just hopefully keep that going forward.
NFL Packers receiver Romeo Doubs had a fundraiser with Gilbert Brown in Milwaukee last night, helping children with spinal injuries. The Packers OTAs are next week in Green Bay. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm Corey Hartman with your forecast. For today, sunshine and highs in the mid-80s. For tonight, partly cloudy, chance of a shower or thunderstorm, a low around 55. On Sunday, mostly sunny, a high of 82. Showers and storms Sunday night, a low around 61. Showers and storms for Monday, with a high near 81.
Right now, it's 70.
What does cheese, beer, and you have to do with local radio?
I know. It's Todd Alba and the Trigby Olsen's What Makes Wisconsin Great Tour.
To get out of your own little silo and just listen to folks, you find out Wisconsin is pretty darn great already.
It's great to be from Wisconsin, Todd. It's just such a fantastic place.
Miss them in your town, more visits, and your chance to connect coming up.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and the app. Earl Ingram.
Susan from Kenosha. Good morning to you, Susan. You say what?
I've been marching since I was 17. I'm 74. And women need to get out. You need to vote because you don't want to go back to 1950 where you weren't allowed a credit card, where you weren't allowed to purchase a car or a home. These are things that are at stake.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Smokey the Bear.
Then you know why Smokey tells you when he sees you passing through. Remember, please be careful, it's the least that you can do.
What you desire, don't play with matches, don't play with fire.
After 80 years of learning his wildfire prevention tips, Smokey Bear lives within us all. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com. And remember,
only you can prevent wildfires.
Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
The Todd Alba Show.
The fantastic Jane Matt Nair of Matt Nair On Air. I'm a big fan of like the Rose Bowl, the Orange Bowl, the Cotton Bowl. Well, now, from Snoop Dogg, they're going to have the Snoop Bowl, the Snoop Bowl. How about that, Jane?
I think we're missing the obvious. Where's the Punch Bowl? Where's the Toilet Bowl? I think that there are other bowls that are being neglected.
I think it could maybe be the Snooper Bowl, though.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
On my next show, I am so excited to be interviewing Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley, my former boss. You're not going to want to miss it.
Weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
And next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Thank you for joining me and my producer, Max. Together, we are taking your phone calls, your texts at 844-967-2789. You can also drop a note into the feed on the Civic Media app and be a part of our discussion as we talk about major issues initially on our weekend broadcast, all about the United States Supreme Court. Two major things happening. One of them on the official docket of the Supreme Court among those 62 cases. The other one of them not, but nonetheless, a matter for decision by the Supreme Court just this past week. It comes out of the state of Louisiana. The dispute is a part of a broader fight, plainly over voting rights, that has come before the Supreme Court in this matter and plainly in other matters. We recall very well the case last year coming out of Alabama, in which the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, determined that indeed legislators there had diluted the franchise, the rights of black voters in Alabama, by creating only one majority black opportunity districts, when in fact there should have been probably two out of the seven districts there. Lots of history there. Ultimately, the Supreme Court having to tell the legislature to do its job. And when the legislature does not do its job, the appeals court, the three-judge panel, does the job for that legislature and imposes the new set of rules, the new lines, the new map there in the state of Alabama, that by a 5-4 decision of just last term. Now we've got another case here in Louisiana alleging many of the same kinds of things. The challenge in Louisiana began way back again after the 2020 census. That census showed an increase in the number of black voters in the state. The state's Republican-controlled legislature then drew a new map that included only one majority black congressional district out of the six seats, based upon the percentages of blacks in that state, in Louisiana. One would anticipate that, once again, there should be at least two majority black opportunity districts, all of that igniting then a court battle. In 2022, a federal judge bars the state from using that map, finding that it probably did indeed violate the Voting Rights Act of 1965. A federal appeals court upheld that ruling just last year after the United States Supreme Court, in what was generally regarded as sort of a surprise decision, found that Alabama, once again, in this other case I've just made reference to, had diluted the power of black voters in drawing its map. So in January of this year, Louisiana lawmakers began drafting a new map for the upcoming election and approved a version that added this second district with majority black voters. Under the new map, and this is significant, the second district in that state links communities in Baton Rouge, the state's capital, in the southeastern part of the state, with Shreveport in the state's northwest. And that prompts challenges. That prompts allegations. Some describe that new district as a jagged, narrow, 250-mile scar linking black majority precincts in Baton Rouge and Shreveport, and as the challengers said, weaving with surgical efficiency to encircle pockets of black voters and exclude whites in other races. So we get a challenge to that new map, to that new map. All of this ultimately comes before the Supreme Court, and indeed just this past Wednesday. In the wake of that, we report now that the Supreme Court on Wednesday temporarily reinstated that congressional map in Louisiana that includes a second majority black district, affirming that new map, increasing there, as they did last term in Alabama, the likelihood that Democrats could indeed gain a House seat from the state in November. But nonetheless, putting politics to one side, affirming once again the import and the meaning of the Voting Rights Act in the early part of the 21st century. The order was unsigned, and the Supreme Court's custom is to do that in rulings on what are called emergency applications. And this was one of those. This is the reason why this particular matter, this Louisiana case, not among that 62 group of cases to which I've referred, it came in response once again to a challenge to a lower court decision that had blocked that map drawn by Louisiana's legislature deeming it a racial gerrymandering. Following all this, it's a lot of back and forth. It's a lot of a legislature saying, yes, indeed, we will follow. We will follow what the courts have told us to do in the wake of the Alabama case, in the wake of what the federal laws have required by the federal courts. We get a lower court that then blocks the map, and the Supreme Court now comes back and says, no, no, the lower court, the blocking of the lower court map, that action is inappropriate, and reinstated that map. Now, interestingly, a majority of the justices appeared swayed by the concerns about courts making changes to election procedures close to an election. But three justices on the Supreme Court, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, and Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, actually dissented on all this. And you might think, gee, how does that happen? You would think that they would probably be very much in support of this kind of thing. And it's not so much about the content of the decision, rather it's about the timing. And while the other two, Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor, did not specifically explain their reasons why they were objecting to the court doing what it was doing, the opinion by Ketanji Brown Jackson, this dissenting opinion, she says to believe that the court had intervened too soon. And she says in particular that we've often denied stays of redistricting orders issued as close or closer to an election. She says that the intense focus on the voting map was proper, since, as she said, the question of how to elect representatives consistent with our shared commitment to racial equality is among the most consequential we face as a democracy, affirming her belief and that of plainly of the two others also dissenting that this is an important concept and that she is not objecting to the notion of expanding the number of majority black districts there, but she's concerned about the timing of this. She said that the question before the judges was far more quotidian, a word we don't often use. It basically means that it occurs every day. This happens all the time, she says. She wrote that the question was merely to decide when Louisiana needed a map in place for the coming election, and she pointed out that a lower federal court had determined that deadline to be early June, the case, again, having a long and tortured history. She says there's time to do that, and that's the reason why she and two others object, dissent to this. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court decision coming out on Wednesday puts back in place, at least for the 2024 election, this new map designed by the legislature there in Louisiana that does indeed craft and develop two majority black opportunity districts. And that is a good thing, as even the dissenters indicate. The objection, once again, based not upon substance, but based upon the timing of this and feeling that the lower courts, others back down below the Supreme Court, could address this issue in sufficient time before the November election. Nonetheless, in the wake of what happened last year in Alabama, in the wake of what has happened previously in other cases, a significant move in support of the Voting Rights Act happening just this past week in the annals of American jurisprudence. We know as well that there is another case pending on the docket of the Supreme Court. Yes, it is among the 62. This one coming out of South Carolina, yet another case involving the Voting Rights Act. And the question is whether or not the decision about drawing lines in that state, in South Carolina, is the product of politics or racism. And we'll talk more about that when that issue comes for decision before the Supreme Court. Again, coming up sometime in the several weeks just ahead. Just this past week, Louisiana told that its new map stays in place, at least for this coming election, probably the subject of more litigation in the future. And that's why many of the headlines on this case describe the Supreme Court allowing Louisiana to go ahead with this for now, obviously going to be revisited down the road. Supreme Court also doing another major thing, this coming off that 62 case docket, that having to do with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, a major case. We have talked before on this broadcast about this so-called attack. It is in politics, in the present campaign for the presidency, a so-called attack on what's called the administrative state. There is no such thing. An attack upon good civil servants who are inside our civil agencies, our federal agencies, acting on your behalf and on mine, acting on behalf of the people of our nation, an attack on these civil agencies and the work of experts, the people who know what they're doing in many, many ways, going on in the political arena, it has also come into the docket of the United States Supreme Court. And we know that because there are at least three cases, arguably even four, right now pending before the Supreme Court, in which this issue about agencies and the roles that they play and the decision-making authority vested in them by the Congress is being challenged. One of those, again, is a challenge to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We know that just this past week, the Supreme Court rejected a challenge just Thursday to the way that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, is funded. And that challenge, had it been successful, would have hobbled this bureau and advanced a central goal of this odd and inappropriate legal movement that is intended to limit the power of agencies and attack the good work that they do on a regular basis. The vote in this case involving the CFPB was 7-2. Justice Clarence Thomas, writing for the majority in this case, the two dissenters, Sam Alito and Neil Gorsuch, we'll get to them in just a moment. Again, had the Bureau lost in this case, the court's ruling as to the CFPB and its legitimacy could have cast doubt on virtually every regulation out there and enforcement action that the agency has taken in the approximately 13 years. It's been in place for 13 years, including ones involving mortgages and credit cards and financial statements, consumer loans, banking, all kinds of things that the CFPB is responsible for now by virtue of its creative and creating legislation by the United States Congress. The central question in this case was whether the Congress had chosen to fund the Bureau had violated the so-called Appropriations Clause of the Constitution. Now, you all know what that is. It basically says that no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. No money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law. That's the language in Article 1 of our Constitution. Justice Thomas, writing for the majority, again, 7-2, says it's just fine. It is, in fact, constitutional. He says this, under the Appropriations Clause, an appropriation is simply a law that authorizes expenditures from a specific source of public money for designated purposes. Straightforward, nothing much to decide here, he writes. The statute, he goes on to say, that provides the Bureau's funding meets these requirements. We therefore conclude that the Bureau's funding mechanism does not violate the Appropriations Clause. Very clearly stated. And although that is the position of the majority of the Supreme Court, turns out that we also have some concurring opinions. Justice Elena Kagan, joined by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, and Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett added that in addition to history, there's also a more recent history that also supports the agencies. There, Justice Kagan, writing for this concurring group, says that the way our government has actually worked in recent time over our entire experience thus provides another reason to uphold Congress's decision about how to fund the CFPB. That's basically Justice Kagan saying, yes, we can look back in history, as Justice Thomas often does, but there's more to it. You don't have to rely just on the history. Our contemporary experience also supports it. In her own concurrence, Ketanji Brown Jackson writes that the court should not undercut the considered judgments of a coordinate branch. She is talking about the Congress, about how to respond to a pressing national concern. All of that supporting this decision. And of course, we also know that had this decision gone in the opposite direction, not only affecting the CFPB, but many other institutions, including the Federal Reserve, from which the CFPB gets its money, could have been compromised, could have been hobbled themselves, had consequences far beyond just this particular decision, could have basically brought to their knees the operation of many other agencies. The court plainly understanding that and appreciating that, the consequences far beyond just this CFPB case. Nonetheless, in his opinion, and yes, the concurring opinions of other justices on both sides of the political aisle supporting the CFPB and saying that indeed, it is constitutional, nothing in violation of the Appropriations Clause, according to our United States Supreme Court just this past week. We'll talk more about this, and we'll get a view from the...
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
Do you have a loved one in a nursing home? California mega millionaire Eric Hovde has some bad news for you. He doesn't think they have long to live. It's true. In a recent interview, Hovde said, if you're in a nursing home, you only have a 5-6 month life expectancy. Almost nobody in a nursing home is at a point to vote. That's shocking. But it gets worse. One of Hovde's companies is named a co-defendant in a wrongful death suit from an incident at a California senior living facility. He even referred to himself as an expert in the nursing home business. Yikes, that doesn't sound like the kind of expert we need. Call Eric Hovde at his California office, 714-730-4444. Tell him that Wisconsin seniors deserve to vote and get the care they deserve. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together Incorporated.
You're listening to News from the Center, WRCE.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this final segment in our first hour here on our weekend review, our analysis of major events in the life of our nation in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice, talking about this major case beginning this period of time when the Supreme Court is going to be issuing other cases in many other areas, this time affirming the legitimacy of one of our major agencies in place for 13 years. The CFPB remains in place in the wake of the decision by the Supreme Court just this past Thursday, 7-2, Clarence Thomas saying it is okay, nothing wrong with the way that the Congress put together the CFPB. We do get some strong dissents. And the reason why they are important is because we've got two other cases coming up in which we may not get the same kind of result. In this particular case, Sam Alito and Neil Gorsuch are dissenting, finding indeed that the CFPB not properly constituted, both of them commenting about the inappropriateness of a decision like this to find that without the appropriations support, an agency nonetheless does have that kind of legitimacy. In his dissent, Justice Alito wrote that the framers would be shocked, he said, even horrified by this scheme. In sum, he added, the CFPB's unprecedented combination of funding features, affords it the very kind of financial independence that the Appropriations Clause was designed to prevent. It is not an exaggeration, he goes on to say, that the CFPB enjoys a degree of financial autonomy that a Stuart King would envy. A Stuart King, he says, that coming out of Sam Alito, about whom we'll talk more in our second hour here on our weekend broadcast. And, of course, in addition to Sam Alito, Neil Gorsuch joining that dissent. They are in the minority, which means they lose on this issue. The majority says the CFPB certainly properly put together by the United States Congress. Two other challenges, nonetheless, out there that may, in fact, reflect those dissenting views of Gorsuch and of Alito. One of those having to do with legitimacy of the Securities and Exchange Commission, a case called Jarchese, in which the petitioner is alleging, maintaining that the SEC in place for 100 years, a century or so, has been operating inappropriately without proper constitutional mooring, based not only upon its initial commission by the Congress, but also because the SEC has not been affording individuals a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment. An absurd proposition, but nonetheless, if embraced by the Supreme Court, would change dramatically, not just the SEC, but also many, many other agencies out there that likewise make decisions based upon experience and expertise and wisdom and judgment and the kinds of things we call upon agencies to decide all the time. That case coming up for decision as well, it is among this group attacking our federal agencies and suggesting that we should all be suspicious of the things that they do. In all of these cases, of course, you can appeal the decisions of administrative actions. You can go into federal courts. But the administrative regime, if you will, has been good. It has been supportive. Perfect? Absolutely not. Mistakes along the way. But on a regular basis, if you're dissatisfied with the decisions of an agency, a federal entity, you can appeal those cases to the federal court, and you may get a court trial. You may get a jury trial, but not at the administrative stage when we need to make decisions, move cases along based upon the expertise. That Charkezi case, the SEC attack, coming up for decision sometime in the next month and a half. And then there's the big one called Loper Bright Enterprises. This is the one in which the Supreme Court has before it a challenge to this doctrine called Chevron, this notion that federal courts should and have for the past 40 years defer to that very expertise I'm talking about, make decisions premised upon the notion that agencies fundamentally, imperfect though they may be, know what they're doing, that the experts are there, they're learned, they're experienced, they're doing their jobs fairly well, if not expertly on a regular basis, and their decisions should not be interrupted, not be suspended, absent some reason to believe that those decisions, those determinations, those rules, if you will, are completely unreasonable. That's the Chevron doctrine that comes out of another Supreme Court case about 40 years or so ago. It has guided federal courts ever since then, and it's basically said that if, and again, the agency has identified a position that is reasonable, it should not be overturned because, again, the expertise is there, and it is not, for the most part, inside the federal courts. That case, Loper Bright Enterprises, challenges that inside a fisheries agency, and yes, it's hugely important for the fisheries agency and fisheries commerce itself. But it carries this larger issue about whether or not the basic concept of Chevron deference, federal courts saying, I don't know everything, I need to rely necessarily upon experts, whether that will continue to be a part of our jurisprudence, a part of our tradition in our United States of America. And of course, that leads to the other case that's also out there. That's the Mifepristone case. The Supreme Court also deciding whether or not the decision by this lower court judge in Texas finding that the FDA's determination, its expertise, should not be embraced and understood, and that mifepristone should be taken off the market. Mifepristone, one of the two drugs that is properly used with health and with safety, according to the FDA. Quarter century of decision-making, of reviewing, of analyzing its efficacy and its health-based support, finding that it is indeed, for the most part, healthy to administer the use and approve the administration of this drug for purposes of abortion. A federal district court judge saying, I don't agree, and substituting his own view for that of the experts inside the FDA, finding that indeed somehow the FDA has gotten it all wrong after a quarter century of decision-making and review analysis based upon the day-in and day-out administration of that drug. The Supreme Court has before it this case involving mifepristone. Again, an attack upon a federal agency. We will see what they do. The hope, of course, would be that in all of these cases, they follow the precedent set just this past week in the CFPB case. Say, yes, indeed, the agencies are proper. They're doing their jobs well, not perfectly. And that's when in those circumstances, when petitioners can appeal to a higher court, they can go to the federal courts, they can go to the appeals court, maybe into the Supreme Court. But the agencies themselves have expertise inside them. And in the CFPB case, the Supreme Court just this past week has said yes. Nothing to indicate that we should upset that constitutional basis for the CFPB. The other cases, slight variations on those arguments, but all of them in the category of this attack on our federal agencies in our political system, plainly, as you have seen, but also inside the Supreme Court. The next 6 weeks going to be animated by these, at least these three cases, determining the future of our administrative agencies. We will plainly talk about all of those as our broadcasts continue into the coming weeks and continue in this weekend broadcast here on Amicus, a law review.
News from the center, WRCE. Jane Matinere and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we kick off the week leading up to Memorial Day weekend with a round of the good, the bad, and oh, please, can we make it stop? Don't miss it.
Matinere on air, weekday mornings at 10.
My doctor told me my cholesterol is borderline, so I took control with Garlique Healthy Cholesterol Formula. Garlique helps maintain healthy cholesterol safely and naturally. It's odor and taste-free, and Garlique is a world leader in garlic potency. I'm taking charge of my cholesterol with Garlique Healthy Cholesterol Formula, cholesterol's natural enemy.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The term natural references only the garlic in the product. Use as directed.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.